back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The feminist Russian punk band Pussy Riot is getting international headlines today after a judge found them guilty of hooliganism for singing a protest song in a church. Three young women were sentenced to 2 years in jail. They've already served 5 months. Now, this is not being widely reported, but the Russian Orthodox Church called upon people to vote for Vladimir Putin in the presidential race, and Pussy Riot's goal was to protest against the close connection between the church and the Kremlin. Protests and solidarity actions are planned in over 43 cities around the world. Many have already taken place. Here in San Francisco, supporters are meeting at the Russian consulate at 3 p.m., 2790 Green Street, and at Justin Herman Plaza at 6 p.m. That's at 1 Market Street. Joining us to discuss coverage is investigative journalist Masha Gessen. She writes for a number of outlets, including the New York Times and The Guardian, and she is author of The Man Without a Face. It's a biography of Russian President Vladimir Putin. And Masha joins us from the streets of New York, where she's currently attending a protest. Hi, Masha. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So before we talk about the ruling and media coverage, we always start on Fridays on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Yes. Well, to be honest, I've been on vacation. I've been trying to stay away from the news media. but of course, I haven't been able to help following the Pussy Riot trial. The thing that's been most useful to me has been essentially a transcript of the trial proceedings kept by a Russian reporter named Yelena Kostichenko. Some of that has been translated into English. I hope that all of it will be translated soon and people will be able to read it at least online. It's a remarkable record, and it really shows what happened there. There was no videotaping and no other way. It was difficult to get into the court building. So it was a way for a lot of Russians to follow what's really happening in the trial.
It's been fascinating to watch. The Guardian has been live blogging. And so waking up this morning, most of the activity has finished. But apparently the proceeding took all day. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Right. The sentence was read for about 3 hours, I think, or 2.5. Basically, I mean, that's actually standard for a Russian court. The judge renders her verdict. So we knew it was guilty from the moment she began reading the sentence. And then she essentially read the indictment for all three women in its entirety, basically showing that the court had completely sided with the prosecution. That's also standard procedure for Russian courts. The indictment is usually included in the sentence in its entirety. And then she sentenced them all to 2 years in prison.
And the judge accused these women of hooliganism and inciting religious hatred. What else stood out for you in the ruling?
Right. What they were found guilty of was felony hooliganism. Hooliganism is this amazing crime that we inherited actually from the Soviet era. And it's in British law or in American law, it would be something like disturbing the peace. So it would be a misdemeanor. So what makes it a felony is that they had to show that it was motivated by hatred. So basically what these women were tried for was a hate crime against the powerful majority. And that's why so much of the testimony in the trial focused on trying to prove that they hate the Russian Orthodox faith and the Russian Orthodox believers as a social group.
So talk a little bit about what actually happened when the women sang their protest song in a church. This hasn't really been widely reported, but for example, Deutsche reported that ahead of the presidential election, the Russian Orthodox Church called upon people to vote for Vladimir Putin, and Pussy Riot said that they wanted to protest the close connection between the church and the Kremlin. But I'm not really seeing this reported in much of the coverage.
Right, that's exactly correct. It was a very pointed political protest, and the reason it was such a violent reaction from the regime is because it really hits it where it matters and where it hurts. The Russian Orthodox Church has traditionally always served at the pleasure of the regime. Weirdly, that was even the case during Soviet rule, which was officially an atheist state. But the very few members of the clergy who were allowed to continue to serve under the Soviets were all on the KGB payroll. And, you know, the state did not stop before using them whenever it was needed, for example, to mobilize for a war effort. The church was very useful to the Soviets then. So the current head of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill, is a former KGB agent, just like the current head of the Russian state, Vladimir Putin, is a former KGB agent. They're members of the same corporation. They act like members of the same corporation. And that was the object of the Pussy Riot protest.
Well, Susan Moore in The Guardian reported that the slide into dictatorship is apparent, and significantly, one of the biggest benefactors has been the church, which has performed a massive land grab. And they also, some reports have also talked about the church expanding their wealth.
Oh, I mean, the church is, I can't even begin talking about this. I mean, there hasn't been that much investigative journalism done into this simply because it's very difficult. The church is a very closed institution. But the patriarch is one of the wealthiest men in Russia. The church higher-ups are among the very wealthy. The church itself enjoys unparalleled tax benefits, has received unparalleled gifts from the state in the form of land, buildings, et cetera, et cetera. It's very much part of the power structure, and the more the state grabs, the more the church grabs.
So this trial is leading international headlines. It was the top story in the BBC. It's all over the place. How is this being covered in Russia specifically?
Well, it's a great question. The state media have alternated between trying to ignore it and trying to portray them as objects of hate and as insiders of hate. It's really polarized this Russian society. On the one hand, much of the opposition, people opposed to Putin, reacted to the original protest quite skeptically. It was too radical or too frivolous for a lot of people's faith. But after the regime's reaction was so violent, of course, they drew the support of many people. And actually, an unprecedented number of Russian liberals have come out saying, I used to have a different opinion, but now I've come around to see this as the most important free speech issue of our time. So that's on the one side. It's radicalized the opposition. On the other side, it's also radicalized the majority. Because whenever the majority is handed such an easy object to hate and told over and over again, these are the people who hate you, these are the people who threaten you, these are the people who want to discredit what you believe in. And as I said, they've been portrayed very much as people who oppose the Russian Orthodox faith as such. That has radicalized the majority as well. So it's had an incredibly destructive, incredibly polarizing effect on society.
We're speaking with Masha Geshin. She's an investigative journalist joining us from the streets of New York, where she's attending and reporting on a protest and a solidarity action with the feminist Russian punk band Pussy Riot. They are getting international attention today after a judge found them guilty of hooliganism for singing a protest song in a church. They have each received 2 years in prison. We are talking about three women, ages 22, 24, and 30. And Masha will be with us for the next 10 or so minutes. So if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on how this is being covered and what it says about free speech in Russia? Fred Weir, who joins us regularly from the Christian Science Monitor, reports a 40-second punk prayer in an empty church. We should also say that it was empty, that damaged no property and harmed no one, is likely to reverberate for months to come, regardless of what happens with this verdict. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And Masha, what can you tell us about how Russia today has been covering this? RT tends to get a lot of praise from progressives in the United States because they give voice to people that don't really get a voice in the mainstream. But we've noticed that the way that they're covering this is by saying that these girls are starving for attention, they're desperate to get attention, and nobody really knows about them. What is your read about how RT is covering this?
Well, I'm not at all surprised. The RT is a state television station that is very much a propaganda tool of the Russian state. I am sad to hear that they've gained some credibility with progressives in the United States. It's a wise media strategy on their part. They show themselves, they position themselves as an alternative voice on the international stage. And they use that credibility to basically broadcast the voice of of Vladimir Putin. But the business of covering them as people who are starved for attention, I mean, that's really Dmitry Medvedev and Vladimir Putin's line. Medvedev said in an interview when he was still president, he said they achieved what they wanted to achieve with this action. The women were already in prison when he was saying, and many people understood him to be saying that that they wanted to be in prison. What he was actually apparently saying, as he clarified later, was that he thought they were starved for publicity.
And so the women have been sentenced to 2 years in prison. What are your thoughts on where this goes from here? A number of reporters are saying that this is going to really change the protest movement in Russia and the call for freedom of expression. Others are saying that this is sort of this gives people a sense of what's to come in terms of crackdowns on dissent.
I agree with both. There's a crackdown underway. And actually, what I would like to do is also mention that in addition to Pussy Riot, who've drawn a lot of well-deserved attention, there are also 14 other people who are facing charges in Russia in connection with peaceful protests. And all of these people are facing real jail time. And unfortunately, they haven't drawn as much international attention, so I think they're going to get even more time behind bars. That's 14 people who took part in a legal protest on May 6th. And who has been arrested and charged with inciting violence, which was actually caused by police.
And I read the Guardian reported this morning that Garry Kasparov, the chess star, was also arrested at a protest this morning.
Right. There was a protest in front of the courthouse. He wasn't arrested. He was detained.
Oh, he was detained.
He hasn't been arrested yet. Yeah, there were about 30 people detained in front of the courthouse. Garry Kasparov was picked out of the crowd. He was clearly targeted by police, and he was very much roughed up while he was in the prisoner transport. And we actually have pictures of that, of Garry Kasparov being roughed up. That's a sign. I mean, that's a message to protesters. We're not going to look at how prominent you are, how well-known you are in the world. You're going to get the rough treatment. That's scary, and it's also radicalizing. When people go out into the streets to participate in a peaceful protest, and plan to go to work the next day, it's one thing. When people go out into the street knowing that anything can happen to them, that's quite a different thing. And there's a lot more potential for violence, and there's a lot more potential for bloodshed on both sides.
And Masha, before we let you go, you're in New York right now to protest. What is it like for you to report on these issues inside of Russia?
What is it like for me to report on these issues while I'm in Russia or in Russia?
In Russia. While you're in Russia.
While I'm in Russia. I don't like to talk about security issues as they apply to me, simply because there are people who actually do face charges, and there are people who are actually in prison, and there are actually people who've been attacked or killed. I think that I've been well protected by the fact that I write for the Western media mostly about political issues in Russia, and by the attention my book has received. I'm a lot more worried about people like the 14 people I mentioned who are facing charges, who are not well known in the West, and who will go to jail and nobody will even hear about.
Well, Masha, thank you so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you on in the future to talk about your book, The Man Without a Face.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you so much. That is Masha Geshin. She writes for a number of outlets, including the New York Times and The Guardian. and she is author of The Man Without a Face, a biography of Russian President Vladimir Putin. And again, the Russian feminist punk band Pussy Riot is getting international attention today after a judge found them guilty of hooliganism for singing a protest song in an empty church. They were sentenced to 2 years in jail. They're 22, 24, and 30, and one of the women is a mother. They've already served 5 months in prison, and you can find more information about them and also listen to their new song at yourcallradio.org. And it's our media roundtable. We're going to switch gears and talk about why the Department of Justice decided to end their investigation into Goldman Sachs. And joining us now is Rob Cox. He's editor of Breaking Views, the global financial commentary service of Reuters in New York. He's also a contributor to Newsweek. Hi, Rob. Welcome back to the show.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you. Thanks for joining us. So as we always do, Rob, we talk about or we give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So I'm just wondering what caught your attention this week.
Okay. Not on Goldman Sachs.
It can be. Well, it can be anything.
Well, I would have to praise one of my people, honestly, for raising an issue about what happens with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you know, all the two giant mortgage companies that were sort of quasi-government controlled. Quasi-private that lost, well, basically had to have a $180 billion injection from the American taxpayer. Well, now that they're making money, we ask the question, what are they going to do with all that money?
Hmm.
Where's it going to go? Is this going to be a congressional slush fund? Are we going to now rebuild these very flawed institutions and they're going to be able to redeploy their capital? And Agnes Crane and Dan DeBiglio, who write for Breaking Views in New York and Washington, sort of raised this question. And actually today, the Treasury came out with a whole set of recommendations and policy changes designed to answer those questions, basically saying we're no longer going to be – this money is not going to be retained by Fannie and Freddie. They're not going to be the behemoths that basically called upon the taxpayer for $180 billion of help. They are not going to – we're basically going to continue to wind them down, and the money is not going to become necessarily a slush fund. But what they haven't answered is, of course – what happens next? What do you do with housing in this country when they go away?
Right. So what does this mean exactly? I haven't really been following Fannie and Freddie for a while. What does this mean?
Well, you know, that we have this, for this country that prides itself on free markets and capitalism, we have this very odd situation where the majority of our home mortgages are essentially backed by a quasi-government agency or two quasi-government agencies. They required huge amounts of capital after the crisis. And they're still basically providing all the financing for mortgages in this country. They buy the mortgages from the banks that make the mortgage loans. That it doesn't exist in any civilized developed nation anywhere. And it's a long term. It's a real problem. Do we want still to have the taxpayer on the hook, or even the government partially on the hook for any problems that go wrong in the housing market? So that's the big question. And Congress, in its infinite ability to do nothing, has actually done nothing. 4 years after we had to inject all that money into Fannie and Freddie, we're still sitting with a sort of weird situation. Anyway, this is a step towards at least saying these we haven't decided what we're going to do with these institutions, but they're not going to get to keep the money.
Yeah. Well, and I'm glad you brought this up, because what do you think overall of coverage of the housing market? And do you think that the questions that you just raised might be raised during the presidential debates?
They should be raised during the presidential debate. You know, it's one question I would imagine someone's going to ask, of both Romney and Obama, what would you do about the housing crisis in this country? And what would you do about Fannie Freddie? Has to be part of that, the equation. I do think there's a lot of people focused on it. There is generally, there is a sense, though, that there isn't a question really is, I mean, there's an existential question here, is whether the government should be at all involved in the housing market. And I still think that that is an existential question that hasn't been answered by anyone. I mean, the Republicans say, of course not. But at the same time, they haven't made any real attempts to change that. And Democrats also say, well, it's not good because, look what happens when you had $180 billion that had to go into Fannie Freddie. There is a question. If you say, and it's all well and good to say we want to get rid of government participation in the housing market or in financing of housing, then what happens? Well, the real problem is you probably don't have a 30-year mortgage in this country, fixed-rate 30-year mortgage, which is a huge amount of risk for someone to bear, right? 30-year credit risk. So you know, you'll have to come up with all sorts of solutions. Maybe we get, you know, you don't see a 30-year mortgage in London or in Australia, say. So, you know, the world goes on without 30-year mortgages. But it's become one of these entitlements, I think, that homeowners believe they have in this country.
We're speaking with Rob Cox, editor of Breaking Views, the Global Financial Commentary Service of Reuters in New York. And Kevin Hall with McClatchy will join us after the break. So let's talk, Rob, about the news that came down last week. The Department of Justice announced that it was ending a one-year criminal investigation and would not file charges against Goldman Sachs or any of its employees. Can you give us a little history about this investigation?
Yeah, I mean, this was essentially an investigation into whether or not Goldman Sachs committed fraud when it put together a complicated transaction on behalf of two very large institutional investors, including a big German bank, and then on the other side of the transaction was this huge hedge fund called Paulson & Company. Now, the way it worked was Paulson sort of went around and said, "Hey, Goldman, I'd really like to take the other side of to bet against a whole bunch of debt securities, mainly debt securities, and these are the ones I really want to bet against." And so they maybe listed, the CUSIPs, which would be the sort of numbers, essentially would correspond to those securities, and said, "Can you find someone willing to take the other side of the trade?" I mean, if you think about it, it's like when someone says, "I really would love to bet against that horse." You need to have someone who bets for that horse, right, at the racetrack. So Goldman went out and found someone who was willing to bet for that horse, take the other side of the bet from Paulson & Company. And that's essentially what happened. The issue was there were a couple of questions. Was Goldman supposed to tell the other side that Paulson was doing this? And was there also a problem in the sense that some of the Goldman guys thought that the securities themselves were crap, basically? Did that constitute fraud? And that was the central question. And the Justice Department decided that basically, while it might have been unsavory, but certainly poor practice, and Goldman will admit that, by the way, it wasn't a criminal violation. And so they won't pursue a criminal charge against Goldman Sachs, which, by the way, a criminal indictment of a securities firm means game over.
Well, so in the statement, the DOJ said there is not a viable basis to bring a criminal prosecution. And then you have Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, who led the investigation, said that the probe found, quote, a financial snake pit rife with greed, conflicts of interest, and wrongdoing. He recommended that charges be brought and said, quote, "In my judgment, Goldman clearly misled their clients and they misled Congress."
Mm-hmm. Well, he has every right to say that. And but basically, a snake pit of greed is you could apply that indeed to the institution he works for. Some might argue, but that is his freedom of speech to say that. But these aren't dumb guys at the Department of Justice. Okay, I mean there's definitely this notion out there, particularly rampant in the press, frankly, that that we should be throwing all these people in jail as if it's sort of that easy. But as the Department of Justice said, it concluded that the burden of proof to bring a criminal case could not be met based on the law and facts as they exist at this time. That's not a political decision. They couldn't bring this thing to the court. They didn't think they had a reasonable chance of winning. That's the rule of law, I'm afraid, taking, which is it's tough, but without the rule of law, we have a real problem.
Hold that thought, because I'd love to ask you how this compares to the SNL crisis when people actually did serve jail time. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show and find more information about the Pussy Riot latest song at yourcallradio.org. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about teachers, or with teachers, as they prepare to return to the classroom. What can we do to support them? In California, they're facing another $20 billion budget shortfall. So what are they facing? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we are talking about coverage of the Department of Justice decision to drop their investigation into Goldman Sachs. And we're joined by Rob Cox, editor of Breaking Views, the global financial commentary service of Reuters. He's also a contributor to Newsweek. And now I would like to welcome Kevin Hall, national economic correspondent for McClatchy. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. I hope you're feeling better.
Thanks.
Kevin, before we dive in and talk about Goldman, I just also wanted to ask you what caught your attention in the media this week.
Well, it wasn't exactly this week, but it was one that I thought to bring on the show. There was a wonderful, very long piece in Esquire magazine, I believe, last month. I don't know if it was the August or July edition, because they always kind of spread out, but on presidential power and how Obama has changed the way assassinations people are targeted for assassination, including American citizens. A very, very thought-provoking piece, very long piece, but in Esquire magazine, looking at how he's changed the way his successors will have to deal with this issue as well. Very fascinating piece.
And so, what can you just give us a synopsis?
Basically, that it's concentrated into the opposite of transparent, a very closed process where the president has the final call, very few details shared. It had to do with the Yemeni attacks and going after the son of the Yemeni cleric as well, and who was an American-born citizen and who, by most accounts, had nothing to do with anything to do with terrorism, but it was decided to take him out too in a separate attack, and how that decision-making process happened. A very, very interesting piece that basically suggests that anybody who backs away from this sort of assassination tactic will be considered soft on terror in the future, and yet it opens us up to the same sort of attacks on us if some foreign country wanted to do the same.
Wow. Well, sounds like we should bring on that reporter on a future Friday show.
Yeah, fascinating piece.
Thank you. We'll find that article and put a link at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, if you saw a story this week that you think deserves more attention, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also post it to yourcallradio.org so others can see it, or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And also, if you'd like to weigh in on media coverage of the Department of Justice's decision not to go after Goldman, have you been following this? Have you seen this? And what are your thoughts overall about coverage of financial fraud? 866-798-8255. So, Kevin, we did link to your colleague's piece about Goldman called How Goldman Secretly Bet on the U.S. Housing Crisis by Greg Gordon. But what are your thoughts about media coverage of the DOJ decision to drop this investigation?
Well, I think it was a tough one to cover because they didn't give a lot of explanation. It was done kind of in an unsigned statement. It was somewhat expected. If you haven't done it by now, the two biggest perpetrators that Greg and I had written about at that time, that kind of led Senator Levin's investigation down that path. Greg and I had done a series of stories on Goldman and Moody's, and kind of what led to the financial crisis. This was way back in 2009. It was real clear that there were abuses. The question is criminal intent. Was there criminal intent? The civil case against the fabulous Fabrice, the French citizen, continues. That wasn't dropped, but that's a civil, not a criminal complaint. I think the government is very reluctant to prosecute these white-collar crimes because it takes an enormous amount of resources, but more importantly, because it's hard to get a jury to understand this very esoteric stuff. Remember that the Bear Stearns, the two traders, the hedge fund traders, the Bear Stearns was the kind of the litmus test. It was a hedge fund that blew up, owned by tied to these mortgage-backed securities that Bear Stearns had bought and sold these stuff, and they had incriminating emails that made it look like a slam dunk case. These guys were describing, you know, how crappy these things were and using that sort of language about them and everything, and still the jury cleared them. And then if you remember in Levin's case with Goldman Sachs, where he was asking, using the expletive, do you think that these things you sold were expletive? It says here in your email that you say these are expletive. And still, you know, they couldn't get a conviction in the Bear Stearns case. And I think they probably thought there's no way they could do it in the Goldman case either.
What are your thoughts? We were talking with Rob Cox with Reuters before the break about criminal intent and how difficult it is to actually send your bankers, for example, from Goldman Sachs to jail. And we often think about the SNL crisis when a number of people were sent to jail. What are the main differences here?
I think one of the biggest differences is the SNL crimes were abuses that happened in U.S. territory, whereas a lot of the Goldman stuff was offshore accounts. It was sold globally. So I think that and the kind of product was very different as well. And I think these complex securities, you know, weren't really completely regulated. I mean, they're just trying to get derivatives regulated right now. You had a lot of this stuff done through, like, the AIG part of it, of this whole crisis was done through the London office. Now we're seeing the London whale and the bad bet by J.P. Morgan. So I think that kind of the global tentacles is part of the problem in prosecuting it, and there was no hard and fast regulator. The SEC regulated Goldman Sachs on the basis of not safety and soundness, but and on how it treats its investors, disclosure to investors, and things of that sort. But that governs U.S. and harder to prosecute overseas.
So derivatives are still not regulated?
Well, some are. They're still in the rulemaking process, and they're still defining, you know, complex swaps and who gets exemptions and a lot of that stuff. So, it, you know, 2 years out, no. The simple answer is no, not completely regulated yet.
And Rob, how would you answer that question about the differences between this case and, say, a case involving the SNL crisis?
Well, if there's a really important distinction, which is you had clear evidence of fraud in the case of, say, the Keating Five. You had there was clear evidence that they had defrauded investors and that the taxpayer, well, I mean, ultimately FDIC insurance was involved. I mean, we don't know all the details with, you know, what the discovery process revealed as part of this investigation over the past year into Goldman Sachs, but presumably they didn't find anything near as clear-cut as evidence as they found in the SNL crises. Or even in they're having these crises now. I mean, they're going back over a lot of bank fraud or bank failures from the crisis, and they are actually, you know, prosecuting some of these. Because there is much clear evidence of fraud. I mean, the real problem is there's so much gray area. It's both, you know, jurisdictional, as we just discussed, but it's also, you know, Goldman Sachs guys thought it was crap and they sold it. But, you know, there is also a certain buyer beware element to this. It wasn't exactly what those orphans that were buying it. It was, you know, in the case of the Abacus transaction, it was a, you know, big German institutional bank. There is a sort of sense that these are big boys out there. They all knew, at the very least, when you pick up the phone to Goldman Sachs, they're not selling you something that they go to church every Sunday to bless. It is a securities product, and you should do your due diligence. You should make sure it's not. It is something you want to invest in. It's pretty clear they didn't do that.
Although Blankfein did say it was God's work, he does. So.
I know, but he was joking.
Well, the investigation, and this was a lengthy investigation. Apparently, the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations amassed 56 million pages of memos, documents, and emails, and they said that Goldman Sachs, quote, used net short positions to benefit from the downturn in the mortgage market and designed, marketed, and sold CDOs in ways that created conflicts of interest with the firm's clients and at times led to the banks profiting from the same products that caused substantial losses for its clients.
Right. And if you were selling cars, that would be fraud, because what Goldman did basically is they sold one set of customers, you know, this great product, you know what the risks are, we've got this, you know, the ratings here thanks to the rating agencies, but you know, buyer beware, but you buy this, and then they didn't disclose that they were betting against this. you couldn't do that if you were a car salesman. You say, okay, you buy this, but I'm going to take out an insurance policy in case your car goes bad in 6 months. That isn't legal in most businesses. It was legal because there was not real firm regulation of this, and it was a new product, a sophisticated product, and no one direct regulator looking at it. So I think
it's also true that they have many other. A car salesman has one customer. The problem with an investment bank, which calls itself, or a securities firm that calls itself a market maker, is that you have multiple investors. You have different kinds of investors. You have different products that you sell them. They have different needs that they want to buy products to fulfill. It is quite complicated. I mean, it's so the conflict, and at the end of the day, a conflict of interest isn't always against the law. We all have conflicts of interest, even we journalists. It's how you manage that conflict. Clearly, the way Goldman managed the conflict was not perfect, and has created many problems for the firm. I think it certainly won't happen. It'll happen again. We all know it'll happen again. But it's hard. The prosecutors just couldn't find enough evidence, obviously, to convince a jury that this was sufficient grounds to put someone in jail, or indeed to put the company out of business, which a criminal indictment has the possibility of doing.
Yeah, where Levin succeeded, however, even though there's not a prosecution, where I think Levin succeeded is in laying out how rotten this entire process was, from the forum shopping or the rate shopping, where the investment banks would go to the three major rating agencies and say, which one of you is going to rate this, give us a bid, and they would basically sit down at the table and then write what they wanted in the ratings and how they wanted to get it, because the pension funds and these big international banks and couldn't buy these products without a AAA rating. They needed the rating agencies. Structured finance is the term for this complex slicing and dicing of bonds. Didn't really exist. If you buy a bond, there's a 70-year history a country has in paying its bonds. You didn't have this for these sort of products, so they had to make it up on the fly. And that's where I think Levin was very successful in showing how rotten this process was, in which they basically, it was almost an arbitrary process, and they brought important witnesses from Moody's and Standard & Poor's forward who acknowledged the way that the investment banks were able to lean to get these ratings, to pressure to get these ratings, and how much money Moody's went from $12 a share to $72 a share, the best stock in that period, all based on the back of structured finance. It eclipsed all their other business. There was a lot of money being made.
That is Kevin Hall, national economic correspondent for McClatchy, and Rob Cox is editor of Breaking Views, the global financial commentary service of Reuters. He's also a contributor to Newsweek, and we're talking about the DOJ's decision to drop their investigation into Goldman Sachs. And if you've been following this, or if you've been following coverage of the economy overall, what are your thoughts and just sort of how to make all of this palatable to people who might not be following this closely on a regular basis? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And if there was a story you saw this week that you think deserves more attention, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also post your story to yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm wondering how you both, or what you hear from readers, because people are still really angry about what's happening with Wall Street. And the World Socialist website has this great quote in their piece about the investigation. Neil Barofsky, the former Special Inspector General for the $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, gave an interview on the occasion of the publication of his book, and he said it was shocking how much control the big banks had over their own bailout. He also went on to accuse Timothy Geithner, Obama's Treasury Secretary, of a cover-up while president of the New York Fed, manipulating LIBOR, the most important global benchmark interest rate. And this is from Barofsky. He said, quote, "Geithner and other regulators should be held accountable. They should be fired across the board. I hope to see people in handcuffs." Kevin Hall, what are your thoughts on this? And what are you hearing from your readers about this issue?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said in his book, on his book tour. he didn't say a lot of that when he was there.
Well, that's usually always the case with these guys.
Yeah. And so that to me is weighs against any of those comments. But I think, as my colleague had said, I think it's awfully hard to bring these white collar cases because the burden of proof is high, the time is high. the time invested in these things. And look what's happened recently. We've got the Barclays settlement, you know, as part of that and ongoing criminal investigation, but they settled quickly. You've got the Standard and Charter. You've got Wells Fargo that last week settled on asset-backed security, something similar to the mortgage-backed crisis. They settled for $6.5 million. That's nothing. So the settlements are happening, too. They're trying to clear the decks in a way. You see a lot of these settlements in the last couple months. And I think the prospects of people in handcuffs is really not going to happen. They've had better luck on the Ponzi schemes, you know, Alan Stanford and folks like that, Madoff. I think the rules were so broad that there wasn't, it's just hard to bring a solid fraud case.
Well, what about connections to politicians? You have to talk about this when you're talking about this case, that Goldman Sachs was the top contributor to President Obama's campaign in 2008, and they gave about three-fourths of their campaign donations to Democrats. Now they're giving 70% of their contributions to Republicans.
Well, they're obviously, they've always been, Wall Street has always been, you know, going all the way back. Remember, the first head of the SEC was none other than Joseph P. Kennedy himself, and he was the ultimate poacher turned gamekeeper, right? I mean, there's always been a strong connection between Wall Street and Washington. Everyone has to realize that. I think going back to the point Kevin made, I mean, there is a larger question here. I mean, Neil Barofsky was shilling his book, and I don't think he's that credible, frankly, on a lot of these matters. But I do think there is a bigger question, which is the system. And you've raised some of the questions around the settlement this week, $340 million that Standard Chartered paid. Now, it's easy to just sort of get lost in the headlines, but look at what happened there. Standard Chartered, you know, UK bank with lots of it, most of its assets in Asia and Pacific, and largely did quite well during the crisis. Didn't get into the subprime mess. Didn't get into all sorts of esoteric securities, all that kind of stuff. As a result, its stock always traded at a premium to the rest of the sector. They came out. There was this settlement this week. Now, what actually happened was quite interesting, and actually tells you that we still haven't fixed regulation in this country. Because while it's really easy to say, hey, New York State Department of Banking, this guy Benjamin Lawsky came out of nowhere. No one knew his name anywhere really, apart from Albany, New York. Came out and charged these guys with $250 billion of illicit trading with Iranian nationals. And got a settlement. There's a real problem here, which is that he completely surprised the other regulators that were working on this case, both the Treasury and the New York Federal Reserve Bank, to such a degree that there was a real panic in the system, which the Fed had to jump in and check liquidity, and you know they were worried about a run on basically on Standard Chartered's New York branch, which accounts for about $250 billion of clearing of U.S.-denominated assets. The Treasury was also, Tim Geithner learned about it from the news wires. It's actually, you could say, hey, it's great, you know, he's going after these guys because they're dragging their heels. But there is a real question about, you know, if you have regulators working at cross purposes, you create a real opportunity for what's known as regulatory arbitrage, where, because you can basically choose whether you have a New York State charter or an OCC charter or Fed charter. And you've now just gone right back to the old days where you had basically conflicting messages from regulators, which is, by the way, bad for business. You should know what the rules are in the process. And you have this sort of headline risk if you're doing business in this country. At the same time, you've got the risk from a regulatory perspective that people are going to try to game the system because they can, because there are rivalries between the regulators. And yet all of this was supposed to have been dealt with Dodd-Frank and after the global financial crisis. In fact, the New York State Department of Banking and all the other federal financial watchdogs had agreed to a memorandum of understanding 2 years ago that they wouldn't front-run each other, that they would work together so that they got the best information before they went after miscreants.
And the last two governors to be elected, I should say, certainly came into office on the backs of going after the financial sector, too. So,
Well, we've got a couple of calls on this. Let's hear from John in Santa Cruz. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Listening to your show, I'm gathering that sort of one of the reasons that Goldman Sachs wasn't prosecuted was because the laws just weren't specific enough to, you know, say they could easily say, yeah, you guys are schmucks, you did really bad stuff, but we can't pinpoint laws that you broke. And my question is, how much of that is due to the fact that these derivatives sort of just came about faster than the laws could be made, and how much of it is active deregulation, where some of these things may be more illegal 10, 20 years ago, and did the laws get actively weakened?
Kevin, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, I think that the back half of that question is the answer. I think they were in 2000, where the Commodity Modernization Act allowed, broke down those Glass-Steagall barriers, and I think you had this massive expansion. If you look at the point in which, remember, this was all tied, you can't separate this from the mortgage crisis that we had here. So you had this whole kind of turbulence in how mortgages were sold into a secondary market, which always had been Fannie and Freddie. Now Wall Street banks created their own separate market called the private label market. They were all bundled into these fancy bonds. And all this kind of happened right after 2000, where you had this explosion of where they could do this with very few people looking in. And at that point, they took almost 40% at the height of Fannie and Freddie's, you know, lunch, basically. So I think it's inseparable from that. And I think a lot of people feel that maybe we should have gone back to that barrier versus the Volcker rule, which is still being worked out, which is very, very complex.
Thanks for the call, John. Let's hear from Jenny calling from her car. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. My question is, isn't it, during the savings and loan, I think they had something like 1,100 investigators, and now they only have, 97? And that's the basic reason why they cannot prove these violations of the law.
Partly true, but it's also an issue. The numbers have changed, but they've shifted a lot. The white-collar crimes unit, I did a story on this right after the crisis broke, you know, asking why has nobody in handcuffs, this like in 2008, and basically the white collar crimes division was so small at DOJ and the FBI because of terrorism, and everything had focused post 9/11, so that's a big part of the story too.
Thank you for the call, Jenny. We've got a couple emails. Celine in Capitola says, what the failure to bring charges tells me is that what's criminal in the U.S. is what's legal. And why could that be? Conflicts of interest between legislators and the financial industry. Dang says, why did Martha Stewart go to prison again? Regardless of whether a conviction is achieved, you can bet prosecutions will go forward for the 99%.
I'm not sure Martha Stewart qualifies as 99%, but you remember she was nailed for an obstruction of justice, not for insider trading. But I mean there is it's understandable that people are outraged, that people don't feel that this is all fair, and it is understandable that people look at the and it is right to look at the link between the, you know, political contributions from business, from industry, from finance, from Wall Street, and the decisions that are taken by Congress, particularly when it comes to the way things are regulated, whether it's reducing the SEC, the number of people at the SEC who oversee finance, or number of people at the EPA, indeed, who look at pollutants. But but there is a sort of broader question. Again, I'm not necessarily defending Goldman Sachs here, but if the Department of Justice had found that for, you know, that a few people had indeed committed some sort of fraud here, and they had indicted Goldman Sachs, I mean, it almost certainly would have put Goldman Sachs out of business. And you could also ask the question whether or not, from a public policy perspective, that would have been the right course of action. I'm not saying, I mean, it would have been a huge, this is a $1 trillion plus dollar bank. It's, if you could argue it is one of the paragons of free market capitalism around the world that the United States uses to extend its policy of free market capitalism, it would have been quite a big political event. So, look, I believe the Justice Department didn't find the evidence to win a court case. I generally believe that is the case, because the people I talk to at the Department of Justice are usually pretty ambitious, and they would like nothing more than to indict and put the biggest securities firm on Wall Street out of business. But certainly, that would have been a really tough question for someone to have to make at the top of the Justice Department and the White House.
Yep. I share my colleague's concern on the Standard and Chartered, just backtracking for a second, because I do think what happened in New York very much caused the equivalent of a liquidity run on the bank, and you know, its ties to the rest of the banking system were drying up quickly, and it had to basically eat crow and come to a settlement, no matter what the price was, to keep, you know, to live the fight another day. And I think there are a lot of due process questions that this raises on how this happened, and I don't think, as a nation, it serves us well when we can go after a foreign entity like that and pretty much bring them to their knees. Over something it's a real complex case called the U-turn. It has to do with a lot of these transactions were legal. It's just simply how they accounted for them.
And we just have about a minute left, but I do want to acknowledge we're getting a lot of angry emails from listeners who say that some of what you're saying sounds like you're spokesman for Goldman Sachs. But it sounds like what you're saying is that this has a lot to do with the relationship between the state and these massive companies to move money and capital. It's really part of the system.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm definitely not a spokesman of Goldman Sachs. You can ask the nice people at Goldman Sachs what they think about the stories we write. But, you know, there is a question. You know, all of these decisions have consequences. I believe that the Department of Justice did not find the evidence and didn't find sufficient evidence. And as Kevin was saying, the Bear Stearns case, where the Department of Justice lost, you know, and looked foolish. Because it failed to convince a jury of normal people that the guys who were calling their hedge fund, basically that they were raising money for the hedge fund, they were saying they had, you know, it was crummy stuff in there. They couldn't get away with it. They couldn't win the case. And I think that's exactly where you are today. But it would have also brought a much bigger question, which is you would have put this bank out of business. Now, again, fine, go ahead. Just like the rogue institution of Standard Chartered, if these guys were rogue, they really were trading with terrorist elements in Iran, shut them down. I have no question. But then why would you settle for $340 million a couple days later? Probably because you didn't have a good enough case.
Well, thank you for joining us. We'll definitely continue to follow this. I'm sure it won't be the last case. Rob Cox is editor of Breaking Views, the global financial commentary service of Reuters, and Kevin Hall is national economics correspondent for McClatchy. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Thank you for joining us, and here's what's coming up on Monday. What can we do to support teachers? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with educators as they prepare to return to the classroom. With California facing another $20 billion budget shortfall, what are teachers facing this year? If you're a teacher, how are you preparing to go back to school? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. How has teaching changed because of budget cuts? And what are you doing to support teachers? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
I'm Jesse Thorne. When MTV News producer Ben Wagner turned 30, he went to Nantucket and met someone very special.
I was standing watching the sunset, and from the edge of the dune heard, "Is the birthday boy here?" And turned, and there he is.
It was Mr. Rogers. What did he talk about with the world's kindest man? Find out on Bullseye from PRI.
4 o'clock, Sunday, here on KALW, San Francisco.
This week on This American Life.
With enough $4 drinks sloshing through our veins, even the most dunderheaded schoolyard japery qualified as coruscating repartee. What do you want? A riposte might begin. A medal or a chest to pin it on? Oh, touche, we cried merrily as we clutched our martinis.
Stories by David Rakoff this week.
This American Life at 1 o'clock on Sunday.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. I'm Shaima Khalil. Today, you're talking about South Africa's Marikana mine shooting.
Why did they have to use ammunition if they could have used tear gas or water or something? Why did they have to shoot those people?
It's been described as the worst massacre since apartheid. 34 people were killed after police opened fire on striking miners. You're also talking about this.
Overall, the action undertaken by the three showed their complete lack of respect, not only for religion, but for morals too.
Three female members of the Pussy Riot Band were sentenced to 2 years in prison each for staging a protest against President Vladimir Putin in Russia's main church. The judge said that crudely undermines social order.